This is Mike Dot with the Relax Back UK show on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. On the Relax Back UK show, we explore all kinds of health topics, so keep listening and enjoy the ride. Thank you for joining me, Mike Dilk, on this week's Relax Back UK show. We spend enormous sums of money on supplements of vitamins and minerals. In fact, in 2020, worldwide, £120 billion.
We all want a quick fix, and supplements are sold to be that mecca, that sort of health mecca. There's very strong marketing around them.
I talked with dietitian Sophie Medlin about why it is such a big business. Is it such a great plan to spend your hard-earned cash on these things? And also, what is in the pills really always that great for us? Then I speak to a couple of people who are starting their career journeys in the NHS. I big up the NHS, the National Health Service in general, and I believe it really is a wonderful thing and has an awful lot of job opportunities in it. And they're not all doctors and nurses.
So far into my course, just the amount that I'm learning and preparing for my placement, it's honestly like the best thing I've ever done.
I speak to a trainee therapist radiographer and trainee adult nurse. So please do stick around for a great show. Thank you.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sophie Medlin is a dietitian, and recently I saw a video of hers on Instagram talking about vitamins and supplements and how some of them contain things we should think twice about before ingesting. I thought, goodness, really? Do they?
Absolutely. It's the Wild West out there, Mike.
It's the Wild West. But first of all, I did a little bit of homework, and I thought, I wonder just how big the market is. How much do we spend on vitamins and supplements globally? Have you got any idea? I found a figure. I don't know if you've got one.
It's huge numbers, isn't it? What figure have you found?
I found a figure. This is just Googling on the internet, so I can't be sure of the source, but 120 billion in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, that's the figure that we work with. I think that's about right. Yeah.
Well, it's just bonkers. And then I thought, all right, that's worldwide. Let's break it down a little bit. What do we spend in the UK? Have you got I found a figure only on the internet. But
yeah, which one have you got?
No, I found in 2019, £442 million.
Yeah, and that's pre-COVID, and I think we'll probably talk about that, but I think that figure's probably, I think we'll probably add an extra 100 million onto that.
So an impossible question, and I kind of specialise in impossible questions, I suppose. Why do we spend so much money on this stuff? What makes us want to do this?
I think there's a number of things going on with that. Everybody wants a quick fix for their health, right? So as much as people like me, as dietitians, might say, oh, you need to eat more fruit and vegetables, and you need to eat oily fish, and you need to do these things, and you need to adjust your lifestyle and exercise more and all those good things, what people really want is to be able to take a pill and for it to solve their problems, because that's much easier and requires far less effort than you know, having to do the lifestyle changes. And that's not the case for all supplements. Some have really excellent applications at the right times and the right people. But ultimately, we all want a quick fix, and supplements are sold to be that mecca, that sort of health mecca. There's very strong marketing around them. If you go to a health food store, if you go to Boots, they'll sell you multiple different supplements. If you ask them any questions, they'll sell you hundreds of different things. And we just get caught up in these sorts of things, I think. And, you know, for most people, Mike, the truth is they've got a supplement cupboard full of supplements they don't take very regularly because they don't notice any difference with them.
Right. Actually, something that I noticed, my wife signed up for she bought some supplements over the internet. And without knowing, she'd signed up for a monthly consignment of these things. So every month, an amount of money was actually, it was like £20 or £30. It was, you know, it wasn't just £2 or something. It was taken out of her account, and this thing arrived. And she hadn't, it was very sneakily done. So they made her sign up without really realizing. That was bad enough. Then after the third month, she thought, right, enough of this. I'm going to cancel it. You want to try cancelling these things. The websites are very cleverly designed to make it as difficult as possible to cancel. So that makes me a bit worried about the whole industry to start off with, I have to say. And
that's a really obviously a moral thing to do with anything. You know, there's no, in terms of sort of consumer rights and the things that we should expect if we're signing up to something on subscription, that should be absolutely clear from the get-go, and that shouldn't be something that you're surprised by at any point. Yeah. But it's a very predatory market, and it's a very lucrative market if you get the right model in place. And people are very keen on this subscription model because, of course, that's recurring income for people. So it's a challenging thing to get right, for sure.
And the other thing that surprises me is if you go for a ride on the tube, or maybe other places as well, but I've noticed it on the tube, there are adverts on the tube. And if you sit down and you look opposite, there'd be like 5 adverts. And almost without fail, 2 or 3 of them are for supplements. You know, and that yeah. seems like too much. I mean, obviously, yeah. anyone can buy an advert there, but it's obviously it's worth their while doing it, otherwise they wouldn't. So, you know, we do seem to like these things.
Yeah, we do, and there's a massive market for it. And I just wish that, you know, fruit and veg distributors had enough money to advertise on the tube and things like that, because we might get a bit more traction with healthy eating as well, you know.
Maybe it's just not as sexy advertising fruit yet. And veg in the same way. In fact, I've never seen an advert for fruit and veg. Maybe that's not true, actually. The packages, the boxes that get sent out every week, yeah. you see the odd advert for them. Okay, all right. So, are your patients? You mentioned COVID. Are the people you deal with, are they recently been taking more of these things because they're worried about COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say most patients that I talk to now will be taking various different things for their immune system that they believe are going to boost their immune system and things like that. So vitamin C is a great example. It's been heavily marketed through COVID for, you know, it has a health claim associated with it that vitamin C can support the normal function of your immune system. But that's been extrapolated by the supplement companies to suggest that, you know, you're not going to get COVID if you're taking loads of vitamin C. And it's a complicated thing, right? Because if you don't have enough vitamin C, your immune system actually doesn't work very effectively. And when you have any kind of viral illness or any illness, you do use up vitamin C more quickly. But whether we need to be pumping people with lots of supplements or whether they could just drink an extra glass of orange juice a day, that's the real question there.
Yes, and probably eating an orange or eating an apple is cheaper than pumping yourself full of supplements.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's in its natural form, so you get the other benefits as well, and there's lots of positive reasons to do that over taking another pill, another capsule that's gone through a factory and is ultimately an ultra processed product.
All right, what about the kind of legal aspect of this? Are there any rules, regulations, laws that cover supplements, you know, because we're eating these things? Surely companies just can't put whatever they want in.
Well, there are certain ingredients that you can't use in supplements, but ultimately anyone can decide they want to design a supplement. So you could say, Mike, I want to put this many million times or 100 times our normal requirement of vitamin C in this capsule and take it off to a manufacturer and they can make that for you. There's not any reason that you have to have any credentials to be able to design a supplement. We've seen over recent years, lots of influencers having their own supplement range, some celebrities bringing out supplement ranges without dietitians or nutritionists on board. And you can see that as a professional, I can see that because they've been designed in such a weird way with things you just wouldn't ever use if you had any education in the area. And then the only place where there is some real regulation around supplements is around what you can say about them. So the health claims that you can make. And still, these are absolutely flouted by the industry, as you can imagine. I see illegal health claims on packages all the time. But whenever you put a nutrient in, there may be a health claim associated with that nutrient. So, for example, B vitamins have energy health claims associated with them, things like helps to maintain normal energy levels. So if another reason why companies will chuck B vitamins into supplements so that they can say, you know, mm-hmm. it maintains normal energy levels and use those health claims. So we have a lot of regulation within the EU. So whether we continue to subscribe to that or not will be up for debate. But there are a lot of legislation in the EU around what you can say about your supplement, but hardly anything about what you can and can't put in it.
Okay. But even the rules about what you can say about the supplement, those are often breached, flouted, yeah, people ignore them.
Yeah.
And so they don't get enforced. So if I was to say make the Mike Dilt supplement, put a ton of vitamin C in it and say, if you take this, your immune system will be rock hard. Yeah. And I could call it the Mike Dilt rock hard
immunity supplement.
Yeah. So I've made one already, you know, that'll be the strap line.
Yep.
I'd be very unlikely to get a tap on the shoulder saying, hang on a moment, you know, you're doing something wrong here.
What it would take is someone like me or like a member of the public to report you to the ASA, to the Advertising Standards Authority, to get that taken down and for you to be told you can't sell it in that way.
Goodness. All right. Okay. So it's quite unlikely. So the thing that surprises me, because we're all spending so much money on this stuff and there's so much money to be made anyway, why cut corners? You know, you'll make a load of money, whatever you do, just do it properly.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I totally agree. And, you know, candidly, I design supplements for the industry and I love that work that I do. It doesn't mean it's not the Wild West, but it's a challenge. The problem that you have with supplements is that the markup is really high. So if you imagine that I've designed your supplement or your vitamin C supplement, Mike's rock hard immunity supplement. Yeah. When you're selling it into shops, retail shops in particular, you want to have a profit from that. The distributor wants to have a profit from that. The shop wants to have a profit from that. So immediately, even if you're selling, buying a £30 supplement, you're looking at something that's probably cost about, it was certainly less than £5 to produce. And if you're buying a £15 supplement, you're looking at something that's even cheaper to produce. And then if you're looking to buy a £5 supplement again, they're probably spending less than £1 on actually creating the supplement. And that's why we end up with supplements that are largely bulking agents, non-actives, full of much, much cheaper ingredients that don't actually do anything in our bodies.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do they put in? What kind of things? So you just said they're bulking agents. So what does that mean? What is that?
Well, bulk agents are things that are put in that aren't vitamins and minerals, aren't active ingredients that you want to buy. They're just there to take up the space in the capsule. And that often is because what you're actually buying is just a tiny little amount and not actually very effective. It might be that they want to make the capsule look bigger so you feel like you're getting more for your money. But yeah. One thing to remember is that if the first the first ingredient on the ingredients list is a bulking agent or a filler, that means you're buying more bulking agent than you are vitamin. And normally those are things like talc. And I'm not sure when you last wanted to eat some talcum powder, Mike, but nobody wants to, and there's concerns about asbestos, contamination, all sorts of things. So there's lots of reasons to avoid companies that are using a lot of bulking agents in their products. And often, especially in some of the sort of leading high street vitamin supplements that we see, there'll be four or five bulking agents and fillers in there because they're just not spending any money or any significant money on their active ingredients.
Okay. I read an article in a magazine now that I really enjoy, which I think might be more a sign of my age than anything else, but it's a great magazine. I'm going to mention its name. It's Which. Okay. And they did some research and wrote an article about vitamins, and they said that they didn't talk about the fillers per se, but they spoke about the actual amount of vitamins. So they said quite often these pills didn't have the amount of vitamins in that they said they did. So, yeah, you know, not only are some companies putting in bulking agents and what have you, they're not putting in the vitamins that they say they are. Have you come across that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a real issue. It's a real issue in many different ways. And one of the reasons, it may seem like it doesn't really matter, right? It might seem like, well, it's just vitamins. It doesn't matter if I get a bit less than what I've been sold. But when it comes to things like folic acid that we need to take, women need to take when they're pregnant to prevent neural tube defects, when it comes to iron deficiency, when it comes to correcting vitamin deficiencies, actually getting enough of those vitamins and the vitamin that you think you've been sold is really, really important, life or death in some situations. And there's a real trend towards this kind of natural supplement market where people use terms like food grown and things like that. But there's no guarantee then that there's anything like what's on the label going into the product. And again, crucially, won't matter too much for the general population, but there are some, as a dietitian who uses vitamins to treat problems, there are a subgroup of people who will really struggle if they don't get what they think they're taking, again, particularly those pregnant women.
Sure. So if people, is there a list somewhere? Oh, this might be a very difficult question. Again, another unfair question. A list of producers or manufacturers that actually do have what they say is in the supplement little pill. It is actually in it. And, you know, that someone's done a test and say, yeah, generally these guys are okay.
So there are third parties that can test the amount of actives that are in vitamins and say, yes, it's got what it says it has in it. But it's quite expensive for companies to do that. And when you think how saturated the market is with vitamins and minerals in supplements, if you look on Amazon or anywhere else, not many companies have done that. It's an expensive process and it's something that you know, you can get away without doing. So why would you?
So the solution might be read the Which article. And then you can find out. I'm not going to mention the particular names here. It's probably not a good plan to. But on the same article, it spoke about something which actually you mentioned already, and that's this idea of misleading claims.
Yeah.
Now, so is this an idea of really people can say semantics? People can use words and get very close to the wire. So we'll read that, not really think about it, and say, of course, that'll be wonderful for my my brain cognition, and I'll be even cleverer or slightly less thick, whatever. And we're just essentially taken in by marketing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of things that supplement brands will do that mean that they get away with it as well. So you can sort of talk about vitamin D, but you can't talk about how vitamin D in your product will improve health. So you might have that on a separate part of the website that's not selling the product. So that kind of allows you to talk about vitamin D and all the potential health benefits of vitamin D without saying our supplement will provide these benefits, because there are health claims and there are nutrition claims. And the health claims are very strict about what you can and can't say about the vitamins, even though there might be really amazing research on the benefits of particular nutrients. There's only certain things that you can say and health claims that you can make, and they're very rigid, but companies will get around that for sure.
Okay, that's quite alarming, really. You mentioned earlier that there are sort of famous people, you know, there might be sports people or actors or, you know, just people in the public eye that sell these things. They might even have their own brand or own line of them. Why would they do that? Is that just to make money very often?
Yeah. They see the gap, they see the market, they go to a manufacturer, and the manufacturer says, yeah, we'll make that for you. So they do, and that's how it works. And they've, you know, whenever I'm working, when I'm designing a vitamin, I will go to the manufacturers and I will give them a list of what I want in there, and also a list of what I don't want in there. And they'll often come back with something that's very different to what I've asked for, because they're used to companies not really caring about the additives and the bulking agents and what they're putting in. They're just happy with that. They also will often fiddle around with levels of things and change things around. And if you haven't got an absolute hawk eye on that, you are going to find that you've made a product that's very different to what you thought you were making, and also has all sorts of things in it that you wouldn't want to, you know, swallow, that you wouldn't want to eat. So it's when you work with manufacturers and they're generally not used to people being very diligent about these things, it's a challenge. So you could go, Mike, with your supplement, and you could say, I want this much and this much and this much of everything, this is how I want it to be, and they'll do it pretty close to that. They'll send you something back and you'll say, yeah, that sounds good, it's about the right price, and off you go, that's the job done. There's no one, there's not a nutritionist checking necessarily, there's not anyone that's doing any sort of significant due diligence on that. What if we're lucky, what the manufacturers might do is to double check that you're not putting in what we call above the safe tolerable upper limit. So that's over which people, we know that people have harmful, they have harmful effects, but on many, many vitamins and minerals, there's no tolerable upper limit. We don't know what the tolerable upper limit is. So, you know, you're taking a real gamble if you're taking mega doses of things over 6 months.
So if you have too much of some of these vitamins, can they do you harm?
Yeah, so some vitamins are more, certainly more harmful than others. So most water-soluble vitamins, if you take lots of them, you're essentially just creating expensive wee, because you will just pee them out. Whereas with some fat-soluble vitamins in particular, you can absolutely overdose. With certain minerals, you can absolutely overdose and cause your physical harm to your body, some of which will be irreversible. Similarly, we just don't know the impact of taking anything at high doses for everybody. You know, genetically, we're all different. We'll process things differently. We'll have different quirks of our metabolism that may mean that things build up more in our bodies and we don't metabolize them in the same way as everybody else. And we don't know, you know, I can't predict whether you're one of those people or not, Mike. You know, it's impossible.
All right. Well, let's not take the risk to some extent. Last thing I want to ask you about is, because I know you've done some work with a company called Height. Mm-hmm. And they're running this thing where you can take a picture of any supplements you're taking and send it into their Instagram account, and they will get back to you and say in detail about the contents of, you know, what the fillers are and all this sort of thing, and also what the if on the on the label it's written what this will do for you, they can say, well, actually, you know, this isn't quite proven or that sort of thing. And I actually did this with some supplements that my wife made, cognitive supplements, cognitive function, and they wrote back and saying, well, yeah, you know, it's probably more or less what they say on the label is in the pill, and there aren't too many horrible fillers or anything, but actually this has never been proven to help with cognitive function. And you know, I found this somewhat alarming, because I just assumed that if this stuff has been sold, someone somewhere will have proven without a doubt that it will help, because why would you sell it? How could they possibly sell it? So it was really quite a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And I like to think, I sometimes think about these things, but obviously not enough.
Well, it's just different. I mean, the thing is, we don't have any nutrition education at school in this country. So how are you expecting people to know? And manufacturers are very clever. You know, it's a very lucrative industry where people are set to make a lot of money if they get the marketing right and they can sell it to you, and it's clearly worked in the case of your wife. The job's done, isn't it? Yeah. They've done their job, and there's no, you know, they don't have any, there's no comeback if your wife says, well, I've been taking this for 2 years and I still got Alzheimer's. There's no comeback to that. No one's going to, they're not going to do anything. They've got no what's the right word, they've got no obligation to deliver what they want to deliver.
All right.
So
I'll tell you the scariest part of the story. All right, my wife is a professor in cancer research. Okay, so she, you know, she's in the, well, she's not really in the world of supplements, but you know, she's not dumb.
Yeah, she's
and yeah, she's used to looking at, you know, an analysis of what things might do for you, and she bought the stuff and made me take it.
And it still relies on the consumer to be educated and to support them. There's not a kind of governing body that really protects the consumer around these kinds of things. And, you know, there really needs to be. And in the interest of time, I'm really interested, or important, I think it's really important that we bring up something that happened last year. So there's an additive that's in many supplements on one of the leading supplement retailers online. It's in over 160, 170 of their products, and it's called titanium dioxide. Last year, it was announced that it's no longer considered safe for human consumption, but it's still heavily in many different supplement products. And from August this year, retailers and manufacturers are being forced to reformulate without silicate, without titanium dioxide in their supplements. But you will still find that many of the supplements on the shelves and on your in your kitchen shelves potentially still have this additive in it. And it's basically, annoyingly, it doesn't even need to be there. It's there to make them look nicer. It's there to make the supplements look a little bit more opaque, so they look a little bit more appealing. And, you know, that's been, people have been taking it for years in their supplements, and, you know, no longer considered safe. There's worries about it potentially causing cancer. So right, these things are
check your stocks and see this stuff is in it. Right. Now, I know you're busy. You need to go. But before you go, please, if this has thrown out questions for people and they want to find out a bit more, I know there's a lot of information on your website. So that's a good resource, but let people know what that is and if there are any other good resources they should go to.
Yeah, so you can come onto our website, which is citydietitians.co.uk. The Height team are doing an amazing job of debunking nutrition things and educating people around the dangers of the nutrition market as well at the moment. So jump on Heights, that's Your Heights, at Your Heights everywhere, online and everything else, and at Your Height, yourheights.com. And you can follow me on Instagram, which is at Sophie Dietitian. And on there, I'm often sharing these different things I'm doing with different companies and sort of trying to raise awareness of the risks within this market.
Very good. Sophie, thank you so much for chatting. I really do think this stuff is important. So many thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Mike.
This show is cool.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, to look at job opportunities in the NHS, I chatted with Tamrin, she's a trainee therapeutic radiographer, and Vic, a trainee adult nurse.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. So as part of the discussion of opportunities within the NHS, I thought I'd start off with a question which is probably a bit unfair, but hell, you know, I'll ask it anyway. Do you actually know how many people work for the NHS?
I can help with it.
I'd go for about 1.3 million in the UK or something to that.
Yeah, case. I think you're right. So I did a quick Google before we started chatting and I got 1.4 million. So there's a lot. And so I thought, all right, let's just see what the latest population of the UK is. So I did another quick Google and I came up with 67 million. So, I mean, that's probably more or less right to the nearest few million or so. So that means that, you know, one in 48 of us work for the NHS, which is like, you know, that's a lot of people. So if you've got a group of 50 on a bus or something, the chances are that one or more work in the NHS. So there's a lot going on, but they're not all doctors. You know, people think the NHS, okay, they must all be doctors, but that's far from the truth. And I'm talking to a nurse and a radiographer, but there's a lot more professions. So before we sort of home in a little bit on what you guys get up to, it might be worth mentioning some of the myriad of other things other than doctors that you can be and work for the NHS. So guys, Vic and Tamrin, have you got an idea of the kind of massive range of professions that the NHS needs?
Yeah, there's plenty. I can think of occupational therapists, speech therapists, health visitors, healthcare assistants, medical physicists, oncologists, certainly people that I've come across recently.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a long list. And I was thinking people that aren't even medical, you know, because there's an awful lot of buildings to look after, catering, all these people get fed, you know, patients get fed. I mean, there's lots of jokes about hospital food, but, you know, people, they have, this is all work that has to be done. Administration, maintenance of medical equipment. The first person you meet when you go into any hospital or any GP practice is a receptionist. So, you know, there's just thousands of different jobs that are required for these, you know, one in 48 people in the UK to do. So, it's a huge vital machine. But let's home in a little bit on what you guys get up to. Tamryn, you're a therapeutic radiographer, is that right?
Well, I'm a student therapeutic radiographer, so I'm a first year student at uni, and yeah, hoping to embark on a career in therapeutic radiography.
Okay, well, you're a student, but you know a lot more about it than me, for sure, I would hope. So the first question has got to be, what is a therapeutic radiographer? I couldn't tell you what that is.
I've been asked that question quite a lot recently. Even when I embarked on the course, friends and family weren't too sure either. Radiography, most people know as taking images. So, yeah, when you break an arm or leg or any sort of diagnostic imaging that's done is done by them. As a therapy radiographer, we actually treat cancer. So we treat the tumour with high energy X-rays. So we do some imaging for treatment purposes, but the focus of what we do is actually treating cancer.
Okay, all right. So it's a case of hitting the right spot so you don't damage the parts that the body we want to keep, and you get rid of the tumour in its most basic form.
Correct.
So you're a good shot.
There's quite a lot of science involved with it. Inevitably, you've got to go through healthy tissue to get to the tumour. And, it's a challenge to get the right amount of treatment to the tumour to kill the cancer cells and not damage the healthy tissue.
So essentially you're doing a vital but actually really quite specialised role within the NHS. That is what a therapeutic radiographer is. You know, it's pretty specialised but pretty vital.
It is indeed. But going back to all the different roles within the NHS, supporting that, there's quite a few different teams that get involved. So the therapy radiographer is the person who actually delivers the treatment on the day, but we're well supported by quite a scientific and, you know, technically sound team to make sure the equipment is working correctly and that the dose for the treatment is also correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's lots of people involved in what you do.
Yes, I was quite surprised on my first placement in the departments at how sort of labour intensive each patient's treatment is from the time of, you know, they first referred and then, you know, diagnosed and then come in for treatment. They would have seen a lot of highly skilled people you know, with a lot of specialist knowledge before they even get to us. And then within our department is, you know, varied roles as well. So
how many different roles are there in your department, Tamryn? Can you
say that again? Sorry.
How many different roles are there within your department?
Well, even within therapeutic radiography, we've got pre-treatment. So when a patient comes to visit us initially, we do a CT scan and set them up in a position that we would then be treating them in later. So we need to be able to reproduce that each day they visit us. And that's done by the pre-treatment team. That information they acquire on the first visit is then sent for to the planning team to be able to plan the treatment. So that's another department. And then once the treatment plan is done, also overseen by oncologists as well, they have to approve everything at that stage. And then the next visit will be into the radiotherapy department to actually start treatment. So there's a team of staff there that actually replicate what was done on the first visit and start the treatment. And then they'll visit us up to, you know, some sort of 5-6 weeks one treatment every day. Others will come in just for a one-off treatment. So each cancer is different. Each patient with each cancer is different as well. So it's a personalised treatment plan.
Treatment plan and a lot of people involved. All right, let's move on to Vic, if I may. So Vic, you are you're an adult nurse, trainee adult nurse. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. How far into your course are you?
I'm only about 8 weeks, so I actually haven't even had my first placement yet. I've got that in 2 weeks' time.
Okay, all right. Well, the question's got to be, are you glad you came so far, eight weeks in?
Yes, 100%. This has been like quite a shift for me, like quite a career change for me. My background is actually in like music and marketing. I was a creative marketing manager for a record label.
All right.
So the shift has been huge. I don't think you could get two different careers, but so far into my course, just the amount that I'm learning and preparing for my placement, it's honestly like the best thing I've ever done.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about adult nursing. Is it a specialty within nursing as a whole?
I would say yes, because I went down this path for university, but you don't have to, which I can talk about next. So there's kind of like a number of fields that when you think about going to university, you kind of have to pick like a specialism. So it's between adult nursing, children's nursing, learning disabilities and mental health. So they're usually like the four different like categories that you can go down at university level to go into nursing. Okay. I picked adult just because of the scope of like mature patients that I'd be seeing from like 18 to 100. And that kind of interested me a little bit more than perhaps children's nursing. So that's why I decided to go down like an adult field.
Okay. And presumably it's a very practical course. There's a, you know, the number of lectures, etc., is a minimum, and you are out there at the sharp end getting on dealing with patients for most of the time. Is that right? You're nodding your head. So
yeah. I would say, like my experience so far of the course, I would say this first, certainly, so we do like a biology lesson, and I would say at the moment, because everyone's come from like different backgrounds and different experience and different levels, I would say like the biology side is getting all the students at one base level, so we all have the same knowledge, we all have the same kind of like the same level of learning. And then we have a lot of theory work, which is, well, pretty obvious, like underpinned by different theories. And then we also do a lot of case study. So we're introduced to different symptoms, and we have to think about using our biology, how we would treat a patient, what teams would be involved in their care. And then I think by the time I graduate, I'll have done 2,600 hours in a hospital and 2,600 hours worth of theory work as well. Okay. And you don't actually become a registered nurse unless you've actually hit them numbers. So it's going to be quite intense. As I say, I'm only 8 weeks into it so far. So I'm not at a different level.
You are liking it so far.
100%.
Okay, good. This might be a slightly difficult question for both of you, because you're relatively new to these careers. But based on what you know so far, would you recommend the path you've taken to others?
Definitely. On two accounts, just to sort of reiterate on what Vic said about the way in which we learn on the course. So the course itself, I think, would be attractive to a lot of people, because and for those maybe who haven't studied for a little while, which I was a bit concerned about, because the way in which the course is structured is an awful lot of practical. So everything we're learning, you can apply directly to what you're doing on a day-to-day basis in a department. I've just completed a physics module, and physics is daunting for most people, and it was for myself, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it this time around compared to at school, because it was very specific to the equipment we use, so how x-rays are generated and all that sort of thing. So it's far more relatable, and it doesn't feel quite like regular study. I don't think at all. It's difficult, but I think from the way the course is done and what you're learning about, it's an area of interest I think would be attractive to a lot of people. And then from an actual sort of job role point of view, my current experience at the NHS is in the vaccine centres in Cambridge with Cambridge Community NHS Trust. And that's been fantastic, because there again, I've had good experience of people coming from a whole lot of different roles within the NHS, different levels of experience, but the teamwork and camaraderie is absolutely fantastic. So I think you know, people are generally quite welcoming, quite supportive. You're all dealing with the same issues together, and everybody has different strengths and weaknesses, and that seems to be recognised. And as a team, you get through both things together. So I think, from my limited experience, it seems a particularly attractive working environment.
All right. Well, that sounds very good. So you would recommend people to follow in your footsteps. Let me ask about something which is, difficult to talk about sometimes, but vital. What about pay? When you're doing your courses, do you get paid? Vic, you mentioned you're going to be doing 2,600 hours work, practical work, before the end of your course. How does that work? Do you get paid for that?
In short, no. However, what the NHS have set up to encourage more student nurses is there's actually an NHS learning bursary, which no matter what field of nursing you go down, everyone is entitled to it. So what we get is, I think we get £5,000 a year extra for every year of our degree, and we don't have to pay that back. That's a grant from the government. So if people are perhaps slightly worried, or they've got families and a mortgage and children, I appreciate it is probably quite hard financially, but there is support out there. And there's also support as well, where if you have a child, I think, under the age of 18, there's also financial support there as well. Okay. So in short... Sorry,
do you get that £5,000 during the course?
Yes, we do, yeah.
Okay. All right.
So yeah, and that's we get the same as therapeutic radiography students, and there are quite a few other allied health professional courses that would be offered the same. So that's a significant difference. I've got a regular student loan as well, which is helpful, but you do have to pay that back, but in manageable amounts. So that's not too daunting, but definitely knowing that we had the extra support throughout the course means one, I do have a couple of part-time jobs, but the pressure's not on to work perhaps quite as hard as I might feel I need to, and I can actually dedicate a bit more time to studying, which is great.
Yeah, which is actually should be your main focus, really. I guess in a few years' time, if I require a radiographer and Tamarin comes along and points this thing at me and zaps me, I would like her to be very experienced and had done all her training perfectly, which I'm sure will be the case. So
I think people can be reassured, certainly in my limited experience on the course I'm doing, the way in which it's taught, because there is such a practical element, and to some extent it probably doesn't even really matter which university or college you affiliated to, because the courses has to meet the same standards in order to gain registration with any professional body that you're going to then work for. And all of us have been in an actual department for a considerable number of hours, where we supervised and sort of tested. So it's quite nice knowing that you're going to come out ready to be able to do that job straight away. It's not something where you've gone to university or college and completed a course and then had to look for something to do and try and match your knowledge and skill too. We training specifically to come out and do that role. So we should be capable and confident by the end of it.
Very good. Glad to hear it. So let me ask about, do you feel that your circle of friends or relatives or what have you outside the NHS are kind of really rooting for you? Do they kind of appreciate what you're doing? To either of you, really?
I think they do. Certainly in my case, they weren't too sure what it was I was doing. So I've had to do quite a bit of explaining. But most people know somebody who has had cancer treatment. Yeah. So there is definitely an awareness of it from that respect, and definitely an appreciation for it as well. So I think even though we might not be totally aware of all the rules within the NHS or what people actually do, we do all individually use the NHS on a fairly regular basis, whether it be for something quite minor or serious. So I think most people, certainly after the pandemic, are much more aware that people have been working quite hard throughout and how much we do rely on these professionals to take care of us.
Do you think we're all a bit more appreciative of the NHS since the pandemic?
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah,
I know I am for sure.
Yeah,
and in fact, just on the kind of on the side of bigging up the NHS, I very much appreciate it more, I think, since the pandemic. But even before then, actually, if it wasn't for the NHS, I'm not sure I would be here. I think I would actually have died as a child, and I think my wife would probably have died when we were having children. So, you know, and those stories probably aren't that uncommon. So I think we know the NHS more than we probably say frequently. So with that in mind, do you guys look forward to Monday morning?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, again, I come from a shift working background, being airline cabin crew prior to this. So, I'm quite happy working shifts. Luckily, with the career I'm heading for, we at the moment tend to work mostly Monday to Friday, apart from on call, which is not all that often because it's spread across the department. But having said that, yeah, that doesn't deter me at all, because a Monday morning would be quite different to any other Monday morning anyway. Sure. You know, each patient is different. You're working with different teams day to day as well. So, I'd say an attraction of working with the NHS, again, depending, I suppose, on the role you're in, is that something, each day is going to be different anyway, so you don't get that regular Monday morning feeling.
But you did mention something very important there. You were talking about shift work, because I don't know what the percentage of people that work in the NHS have to do shift work, but that's a big deal, actually. That doesn't kind of suit everyone. What's your experience of shift work? Have you had an experience yet in your course?
Not so much within the NHS. I haven't done shift work other than weekend work. But I would, again, not want people to be deterred thinking that NHS work means shift work, because that's not true at all. Certain roles, you won't be able to avoid it. But even as you progress through your career, you could still potentially pick and choose certain departments or certain hospitals or certain areas within that role that you would probably be able to avoid some of it. So yeah, doctors and nurses, I think that's going to be very much a way of life. But in the allied healthcare professionals, in all the other jobs that you mentioned in terms of the supportive administration roles and all that sort of thing, it can quite easily be a regular Monday to Friday job as well. So yeah, if you had a good look at all the roles, you'd find something that fitted your criteria.
Good. Right. Well, I mean, chatting to you both, it certainly seems that you are very happy to have gone down this path. So I wish you both the very best of luck. Lastly, let me ask, if people are thinking about a career in the NHS and they'd like to find out a bit more about all the different kind of things that are available, medical and non-medical and all the rest of it and what it all entails, is there a good resource for people to find out about this stuff? And so what is it?
There's some fantastic resources. I mean, it's simple really, as really just googling NHS careers. That would bring up plenty of information. But there is a jobs.nhsuk website, which quite clearly breaks down a wide range of roles. So it would be a good starting point if you didn't even know what to go for, or if you had if you don't have a particular interest. It would give you a lot of opportunities to investigate further. And then through the website, it leads you to various links to discover more.
Okay.
When I didn't quite know what area of nursing I wanted to go down, and I wasn't sure what paths I could go down, because I think it's really important that people know as well that you don't have to go to university to become a nurse. So when I started looking into this as a career, obviously I already had a degree. It was a creative degree. It wasn't, science or medical related. And there's actually opportunities for people to do top-up degrees. And what they'll do is they'll kind of work with like a portfolio and work experience on top of what they've already got. So in some cases, you know, you don't even need to go back to university. I did, and I wanted to, and I'm quite lucky that I was able to. But I actually started with going to NHS Careers, and I had a call. I can't remember the lady's name. I had a call with somebody, I think, called Sam, and I chatted to her about what qualifications I'd had, what I wanted to do, where I was living, like my living circumstances. And the first thing that I did is I just spoke to a few local universities, and they kind of pointed me in the right direction of, well, I was too late graduating to do a top-up degree, but there was, you know, other universities in the area. And I think as well, what people should really look into is the NHS now doing a scheme called the Nursing Associate Programme. So with that, you actually start work as a Band 3 nurse and you learn and train at the same time. Mm-hmm. When you've qualified for that, there's then a decision at the end if you want to go on and do a degree as like a top up on what you've got. So that would mean then I think you would probably qualify doing that on a Band 3 or 4 wage. And if you were to go to university and top it up, you would then qualify on a Band 5. So I just think it's really important, because I've spoke to friends who really want to get into nursing, and they're saying, well, you know, I've got a family to support, I can't go to university. But actually, university isn't the only option for people. And I think the more people that know about that, I think it actually relieves a little bit of pressure and think, well, I haven't got to go back to education.
I think that's a very important point. So thank you. Thank you, Vic, for mentioning that. Both of you, or one of you, give that website one more time so people can hear it. You mentioned it, Tamara.
Jobs.nhs.uk.
Perfect. Guys.
NHS Careers.
I think people, I hope people will find that interesting and make them sit up and think about a potential career in the NHS. So thank you very much indeed, Vic and Tamara, for chatting.
Thank you.
And thank you for promoting roles within the NHS.
Very much to my guests on this week's show. And of course, thank you to you for listening. That was the Relaxed Back UK show with me, Mike Dill. Thank you for listening. And please do join us again next time.